Greetings and welcome to another lesson from 1 Samuel. This is from chapter 2, verses 11 through 36, and I've entitled it Making God Weighty or Honoring God. What we'll see throughout the rest of this chapter is that Hannah and Eli's sons are contrasted. Begins with Samuel ministering to the Lord in verse 11. And Eli's sons are compared or contrasted with Samuel in their contempt for the sacrifice in 12 through 17. Samuel continues to minister and grow in verse 18 through 21, while Eli rebukes the growing sins, great sins of his sons, the immorality, and 22 through 25. Samuel continues to grow in stature and favor with man and with God. But in verse 27 through 36, Eli's house is rejected. And in chapter 3, verse 1, Samuel is serving before the Lord. So, ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest, let's read verse 11. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. You'll notice, if you pay attention in chapter 2 and 3, is that the word for boy, or Nahar, is repeated several times. In fact, it covers a great range of ages, from not weaned in chapter 1, verse 22, to weaned in chapter 1, verse 24, which is probably about age 3, to, in chapter 2, and beginning of chapter 3, a boy, as in Samuel's case. Eli's sons are called young men, or translated as young men in verse 17, but also using the same term. And also it refers to priest servants, verse 13 and 15. So a great range of meanings, but it's important for us to understand in chapter 2. One author suggests that this term is used of men until they are married. Well, Samuel was ministering, that is, he attended Eli near the Ark of God, according to chapter 3, verse 1. So he was inside the tabernacle or the tent of meeting. Well, the word sometimes means to attend or take care of, if that's a sense here. And in 3:1, according to Omen's son, the sense is that Samuel was serving the Lord by attending to the care of the Ark. It could also refer to personal service, such as Joseph and Elisha's case. And the term also could be referring to caring for a place of worship, according to Numbers, or to the furnishings, or to the lamps burning within the tabernacle. So we're not quite sure exactly how or what Samuel did ministering to the Lord, but we have an idea of how he did it in the last part of verse 1. It was to the Lord, this phrase is repeated in chapter 3, verse 1. Samuel was serving the Lord, not Eli, though he did it before Eli. It suggests maybe there's some kind of apprenticeship under Eli's guidance, according to one commentator. In chapter 1, this was the prayer of Hannah. As soon as a child is weaned, I will bring him, that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Well, he was also in the presence of Eli the priest. And the high priest maintained order in the sanctuary. He guarded the gate during the day and determined who may or may not enter and if the offerings were proper. But we also know that he was incompetent because he mistook Hannah's silent prayer in chapter 1 before the entrance as drunkenness. And at nighttime, he guards the sanctuary by sleeping nearby. We find him doing that in chapter 3. When the Lord calls Samuel. Well, how about some application real quick? Well, as a young boy, Samuel ministered to the Lord. And a question that might be raised is, how do we involve children even before they know the Lord? Samuel didn't know him at this time. How do we encourage our children to assist others, to care for church campus? I recall an instance when I was preparing for a transplant, recovering for a transplant of a mother who made a point of having her daughter pay attention to or to care for one of her Awana leaders. That was me. It was amazing. The pictures, the small gifts, the letters and cards, it was special. Well, to the Lord, in the midst of corrupt religious leaders, Samuel still thrives. So how do we teach our children about the presence of God when we live in such an imperfect world, and maybe in a corrupt world at that? Well, Samuel, not Eli's sons, ministered to the Lord. So there are two choices here. You can minister to the Lord in a corrupt environment, or you can pursue sin. So the question you might raise is, what stops us from ministering in church? People? Circumstances? Eli's sons, in the same situation, grew progressively worse, and we'll see that through the rest of this chapter. They went from stealing food from offerings and being abusive to offerers to immorality with women who served at the entrance and contempt for sacrifices. Well, let's look at Eli's worthless sons in verse 12 through 17. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when the man offered sacrifice, the priest servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if the man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, and then take as much as you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. So why were they worthless? Well, the term worthless, or sons of Belial, also translated as base fellows or miscreants, were generally referring to a person who had become so wicked and corrupt that he or she is a detriment to society. It always implies wickedness as well as worthlessness, 1 Samuel 2:12 and 1 Kings 21:10, sometimes sheer destructiveness, according to Kidner. Examples of worthless fellows include those that drew away Israelites to go and serve other gods, probably Baal in Deuteronomy 13:13. They were also the immoral men of Gibeah in Judges 19:22 and chapter 20, verse 13, only a few miles away from where this takes place. Nabal gave false witness against Naboth in 1 Kings and 21:10 through 13. And Samuel's sons, believe it or not, turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. They too became worthless. And the opponents of King Saul and David in 1 Samuel 10:27 and elsewhere are considered worthless. And finally, Samuel's mother, Hannah, protests that she is not a worthless woman to Eli. Wow. So why were they worthless? Well, it begins with, they did not know the Lord. They did not know Yahweh, the personal name of God, and that's repeated in verse 12 and 17. It kind of frames the paragraph. Eli's sons did not know the Lord, that is, they did not regard or pay due respect to the Lord. Their knowledge of God remained only a superficial formality, according to Sumerah. Further, another author suggests the clear implication is that their activities were evil and that they had turned away from Yahweh, and we'll see Eli calling their activities wicked later on in this chapter. Well, Samuel also didn't know the Lord, and that's 2 verse 12 and 3 verse 7 of 1 Samuel. While Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, were despising the Lord, Samuel was serving him. What a contrast. Fortunately, Samuel will know the when the Lord of the when the word of the Lord is revealed to him in verse 7 of chapter 3. So the contrast between those who didn't know the Lord and despised him and those who didn't know the Lord and yet served him. So here are some of the accusations that are made. Well, it was a custom of priests at Shiloh, verse 13 through 15. So it's hard to find exact sacrificial regulations for what was going on. Deuteronomy 18:3 through 5 speaks of the priests' due from the people, including food and the order of the sacrifice. We don't know for sure what kind of sacrifice because it's described in a couple of different ways. The word sacrifice in verse 12 and 29 is zeba. It's used mainly of killing animals for sacrifices, according to Wolf. And the other term, offerings or minna, typically refers to a cereal offering or grain offering or even a meat offering in verse 17 through 29. So it could be both. But fat portions were always burnt first. They were the best part of the sacrifice, according to Leviticus. They were always given to God before what was left of the sacrifice was given away. The fat was burnt as an aroma pleasing to the Lord, according to Leviticus 3:5. Eli's sons did not deserve it. Well, they despised the offering of the Lord is the way it's summed up in verse 17. We know that they took more than their fair share in 13 and 14. They were fattening themselves on the choicest parts of the very offering, of every offering, excuse me, verse 29. They weren't following the rules. They insisted on raw meat instead of boiled meat. They took their share before God's share, by force if necessary. And thus they treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. Jenny says this results from the arrogance that leads to evil, that leads evildoers to conclude that they need not regard God. And Eli's son should know better. The offering sacrifice not according to the rules turned out bad for Korah in Numbers 16, verse 30. What's the application? What can Eli's sons teach us about worship? Well, it's not about making us feel good. For many Western Christians, a criterion for evaluating worship is how good it makes them feel, whether they enjoy it, whether it gives them a sense of being in God's presence, whether they feel encouraged and built up by it, according to Golden Gate. Well, Eli's sons got fat on it. They enjoyed it. Second thing is spiritual leaders can be human. I like the way Davis puts it. Hannah's prayer in chapter 2, 1 through 10 has just alluded to the arrogant, verse 3, the mighty, verse 4, the wicked, verse 9, those who contend with Yahweh, verse 10. And here they are, not as expected, Canaanites or Philistines, but the priests of Israel. Wow. Third point, ministers can be tempted. Eli's son do so for the usual ordinary human reasons, sex and money, or at least the possibility of keeping body and soul together, 1 Samuel chapter 2. And there are other examples in Jeremiah and Micah. Among other effects, such a story would stand as a warning note to treat ministers as if they are exempt from the rebellious inclinations of the people as a whole. Ministers can and are often tempted. Furthermore, worship is more than just ritual, even though Eli's sons weren't really following the ritual. But 1 Samuel 15:22 comes to mind with regards to Saul. To obey is better than sacrifice. And Hosea says, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings in chapter 6. And of course, David says this in Psalm 51, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise. And Paul reminds us and exhorts us to present our bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship in Romans 12:1. Let's move on. Here's the contrast. Samuel's family is blessed by the Lord in verses 18 through 21. Let's read that. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod, and his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year, and when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." So then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord. Some might want to just say, "Ah," and talk about how cute it seems that Samuel's dressed up as a priest, but recall the context, a very corrupt priesthood. Well, he ministered before the Lord. We've seen that before in verse 11. But here his ministry is not before Eli, as it was in verse 11. Perhaps he's gained some independence or some ability. And the verbal construction suggests an ongoing activity, something ingrained in Samuel's lifestyle. This was a pattern of his life, ministering before the Lord. Well, he was wearing a linen ephod, so this is what a priest's garment would wear, what a priest would wear when involved in worshiping activities. We see that in verse 28. It's an indication that Samuel has become involved in an apprenticeship. Well, he also had a little robe to wear, verse 19, also a priestly garment, according to Exodus 28. It was a cloak worn by a high priest over his ephod, Exodus 28:31, but also by others of importance. 1 Samuel 15:27, I think, refers to Saul. It was the outer garment called a simla, was square and a blanket-like material and was used to covering at night. So not only did he wear an ephod, but also a little robe. And that robe comes up again, well, later renditions of it, when Samuel's robe is torn by Saul to symbolize the loss of the kingdom in chapter 15. And it was proof that it was Samuel's ghost when the witch of Endor calls up Samuel's ghost because Saul wanted him to, chapter 28, verse 14. Well, let's look at the blessing of children in verse 10 through 21. Then Eli would bless, well, actually, verse 20 and 21. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife. The context suggests repeated action and describes something that happened each year. So for a number of years, they were blessed. Well, actually, the phrase "give you" is directed to Elkanah because it's masculine or singular. Sorry, ladies. But it's children by this woman. And it was because of her petition was for a child, Samuel. Or rather, her petition was for a child, Samuel. Eli's petition was for more children. He outdoes her in this case. The Lord who took note of Hannah is the one who actually blessed Hannah by bringing children into his life. Petition granted. There are three sons and two daughters. Well, in the presence of the Lord, what does that mean? Literally, with Yahweh, the personal name of God. Well, the ark and the bread of the presence symbolize God's nearness in 2 Chronicles 4:19. So there are some things around the tabernacle or tent that would have reminded Samuel of the Lord's presence. And the most common Hebrew term for presence is panim, which is also translated face, implying a close and personal encounter with the Lord. Psalm 130 verse 7 talks about what the presence of the Lord is like. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption. Well, in this context, it suggests that Samuel enjoyed a childhood marked by divine favor and a lifestyle evidencing a Moses-like relationship with the Lord. They must have been very close, despite the corruption of the tabernacle. Well, what's some application for us? Well, children are important to God. Scripture takes seriously the commitment of children to his service, and Jesus was to warn against corrupting children by ungodly behavior, Matthew 18 and 19. The example of Samuel shows up the perversity of his seniors simply by contrast. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea, are Jesus' words in Matthew 18 that we are all very familiar with. F.B. Meyer applies this lesson to our own parenting. Mothers still make garments for their children, not on the loom or with their busy needles merely, but by their holy and ennobling characters displayed from day to day before young and quickly observant eyes, by their words and conversation, and by the habits of their daily devotion. There you go, Mom. Let's go back to Eli's worthless sons in verses 22 through 25. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings with all these people. No, my sons, it is not good. It is not a good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. So what did Eli hear about his sons? Well, Eli was very old. It seems that some time has passed since the last episode. Eli is now already very old, according to one commentator. And probably semi-retired. From the age of 50 years, they shall withdraw from the duty of the service and serve no more. They minister to their brothers in the tent of meeting by keeping guard, but they shall do no service. Exodus 38. Well, if that was a custom of Shiloh, then perhaps Eli was only guarding the tent of meeting rather than some of the other services. But he kept hearing. It's a repeated action. He kept hearing, listening to the reports. But what were they about? Well, evil doings. Again, verse 22 through 25. It's abuse of the worship and of the worshipers. In addition, abuse of women who had served at the entrance. So things have progressed from verse 12 through 16. And perhaps these women were Nazarites involved in volunteer service. We don't know exactly. Some would suspect that maybe they were cult prostitutes, something that they would have learned from the environment around them. In fact, this problem was frequent in Israel's history, in Genesis, Numbers, Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, and Amos. And if they were not cult prostitutes, they were being treated as though they were pagan shrine prostitutes, like Hosea 4:14, according to one commentator. Another author says, "When Hophni and Phinehas slept with the women who ministered at the entrance to the tabernacle, they were borrowing the Canaanite practice." Well, it would be wrong of me if I didn't mention something about ministry to abused women in the church. It's more common than we might think. One author with the Gospel Coalition mentions that 1 in 6 women have been victims of sexual harassment and assault. How many are there in our church that have had that experience? She goes on to say that 1 in 4 women will have an abortion by 45. She mentions that abuse and assault victims often believe the lie that they were the ones at fault. Wow. It's important to note here that the women here are serving at the entrance of the tent of the meeting. They are not the ones being accused. Eli's sons are being accused. In addition to an assurance of pardon for their own sins, she goes on, they need an assurance of justice for the sin committed against them. Well, we can be certain Hophni and Phinehas' actions are called evil and sentenced to death by the Lord. And perhaps there is some justice there. Well, what exactly was Eli hearing? "No, my sons," he says. So he's rebuking them for what he heard. The Revised English Bible suggests a translation of "Stop it now, my sons." This may be Eli's first recorded rebuke of his son's misconduct. Came when he was very old. The writer may be implying that Eli neglected his parental responsibilities early in life. Says one author, we may compare Samuel's own sons, but especially David's own son as examples. Well, there were no good report. It was news, a rumor, a report, a message used as sema of news or report that is received, whether good or bad. And it was spread abroad. I like the way the Good News Translation puts it. The people of the Lord are talking about it. Can you imagine what would have happened if Eli had cable news or social media? Well, why was the report bad? Well, it was a sin against the Lord, or sins against the Lord. Eli's challenging question was based on legal procedure and pictures God as judge. Imagine, a judge can arbitrate between two men, but if somebody does something wrong to the judge himself, then there's no possibility of avoiding judgment. As one lexicon puts it, if one sins against God, he doesn't have a prayer. Some have compared this to the sin of the high hand, or sin against God, as we find earlier in the Pentateuch. Edwards mentions this, the law does not provide atonement for all sins, but only for sins of ignorance or inadvertence committed within the covenant. Deliberate sins fall outside of the scope of priestly meditation. They had no hope. Well, it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Wow, this is an interesting question. Why? Well, because they would not listen. Like the Pharaoh of Exodus 5:2, who said he had no intention of heeding the voice of the Lord, and thereafter became increasingly obstinate until the Lord hardened his heart. So Hophni and Phinehas sealed their own fate by their refusal to take warning, like Romans 1:18. The term "for" explains why they would not listen, as in obey. God had decided to put them to death, so it was God's will for them not to listen. But furthermore, Hophni and Phinehas are clearly committed to their course of action. In their hearts, there's no turning back. They had long hardened their hearts, and God at length gave them up to a reprobate mind and determined to destroy them. 2 Chronicles 25:16. Well, how about some application? Our need for reproof and a mediator. Proverbs 15:5 says, a fool despises his father's instruction, but whoever heeds reproof is prudent. We need reproof. But if we despise it, as a term used also in verse 17 of 1 Samuel, we are a fool. Furthermore, whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves his son is diligent to discipline. How diligent are we to discipline our children? And a mediator. Well, can think of no better mediator than Jesus Christ. Since every human being is a sinner and sins against the Lord, Psalm 51:4, does not Eli's rhetorical question suggest that there's no hope of sinners being interceded for? Paul's conviction is that Job's question was answered in Jesus. For there is one God and one mediator between God and people, the human Christ Jesus, from 1 Timothy 2:5. And now back to Samuel, who continues to grow in stature and favor. Verse 26, now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. Well, he continues to become great in the sight of the Lord. In stature, it means becoming great or rich or growing up. Samuel grows, he becomes great, well, in the presence of the Lord, in his stature and favor with the Lord and with people. And later in chapter 3, verse 19, Samuel grew and the Lord was with him, so none of his words fail. He grew as a prophet. He also grew in favor, having the goodwill of all the people, or of all the people were pleased with them, Luke 2, verse 52, I think you can understand which youth that is talking about. Well, Hophni and Phinehas become great sinners in the sight of the Lord. Verse 17, the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. Well, Eli blessed Elkanah and Hannah because of Hannah's prayer for Samuel, but he rebukes his own sons for their sins against God. Hophni, Phinehas, and Samuel have some similarities here as well. They must have had similar religious education opportunities, but the sons of Eli became great in their sins, while Samuel became great in his faith. How does one explain the differences? Sin is deceptive and has a hardening effect on the human heart. When people continuously choose sinful attitudes and actions, they gradually become hard-hearted and turn away from the living God. But those who persist in faith will grow stronger and stand firm to the end in the confidence they had at first, Hebrews 3 reminds us. You might raise the question, were Eli's sons kept for repenting? Well, we need to recall that hearts are generally hard, that they are deceitful above all things and incurable, that they are capable of unlimited wickedness and deceit, according to Jesus, and that God's mercy is given to those who do not deserve it. His hardening affects those who have already by their sin. But the hope is, and the promise is, that God changes hearts of stone, according to Ezekiel 11. And I will give them one heart, and a new spirit I will put it within them. I will remove the heart of stone from their flesh and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my rules and obey them. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Well, back to Eli's sons. They were scorning God's grace, verse 27 through 29. And there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, thus says the Lord, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to my priest to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded for my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Well, there are accusations of the man of God in verse 27 through 29. But who was he? Well, man of God is a synonym for prophet, but other than that, we are not given a name. But here are the accusations. First of all, Eli's sons were ignoring clear revelation. The revelation to the house of your father goes something like this. Bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests, from Exodus 28. We know that they were abusing their ministry in verse 28. Go up to the altar, bring people's sacrifices, burn incense means with intercessory prayer, and to wear an ephod before me would include 12 stones representing Israel before the Lord. So they were to serve the people. Well, it's summed up as contempt, which means to kick out the Lord's sacrifices and offerings. Verse 29, they were ignoring God's commandments, meant they were dishonoring him. Verse 30, you scorn and fatten yourselves are plurals. It wasn't just Eli's sons, but include Eli because he allowed it. He did not restrain them. And by participating, the word heavy occurs in chapter 4, verse 18. Well, honoring family over faith is an application. What was Eli's responsibility and what's ours? His responsibility is emphasized by the reference to honor in verse 29 and 30. The question is raised, do we model honoring God before our own families? Family can become an idol. The man of God rebukes the sin of sweet reasonableness, the willingness to tolerate sin, to allow God's honor to take a back seat, to prefer my boys to my God. For Eli, blood was thicker than fidelity, according to Davis. DeYoung raises this from Mark 3. In Jesus' view of the family, family ties don't get you in. Family doesn't come first, and God's family is open to all. That is, open to everyone who does the will of God and takes Jesus on his own terms. Well, back to more on Eli's family. In this case, it's judgment, verse 30 through 34. Therefore, the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house. So there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. Verse 31 through 36. So what was the punishment? Well, it's important to observe that the oracle of the Lord is mentioned twice in this first verse of 31. It's very solemn. Out of 254 times the phrase is used, it's only here in the same verse. Well, there's a promise here to minister before the Lord that they should go in and go out before me forever. But we find that there's a condition. The phrase, far be it from me, is used 11 times in Samuel out of 21 times. It usually refers to how determined the Lord's judgment was and how severe his anger was at the dishonor which the priestly family had brought upon him. Hear the phrase, far be it from me, in Samuel, that's not a good sign. Furthermore, the condition is for those who honor me, or the promise is, that is, to make weighty, and thus the title of this message. But also, the condition is for those who despise me, that they will be lightly esteemed. The term is to be slight, swift, trifling, or of little account. It's the opposite of baza. I'm sorry. To honor, kabed, is the opposite of baza from 1 Samuel 2:30. So it's reciprocal. If one honors God, he will be honored. If one despises God or thinks of little account of God, he will be treated of little account by God. Well, how did this work out in Eli's family? Well, here's a flow chart, if you will, on the right of the ancestry of Zadok. As you can guess, that the faithful priest promised here appears to be Zadok. Well, it begins with the days that are coming. If a prophet announces a decree of the Lord that begins with the days are coming, watch out. Most of the time it's used in the later prophets. It's always spoken by the Lord. It refers to judgment, particularly the day of the Lord. Well, what's going on? Eli's arm will be cut off. Literally, your strength will be cut off. He is the last old man in the family line in chapter 4, verse 18. Specifically, it's the young men who are vigorous and at the peak of the strength that are the arm of the family, if you will. And we find later on in 1 Samuel 22 that Eli's descendants are murdered by Doeg the Edomite, except for Abiathar, so the one person who escapes in 1 Samuel 22. Abiathar is expelled for supporting a rival to Solomon's throne in 1 Kings, so Zadok replaces Abiathar, and the line ends. But Aaron's line, which was what the promise was made for originally, is not cut off. Zadok comes from a different branch of Aaron's line, 1 Chronicles 6 says. So this promise of perpetual priesthood is fulfilled with Zadok. Verse 35 through 36, a prophecy of a faithful priest. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And every one who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread. So who is this faithful priest? Well, it's somebody raised up by God, just like the promise of a prophet in Deuteronomy 18:15. And he's from among the people of Israel. Furthermore, he's a faithful priest. The phrase has a root meaning of to have stability, to be reliable. And Samuel is later attested as having stability or being reliable as a prophet in chapter 3 and chapter 7 and chapter 9. But it's also a faithful priest who will act according to God's heart. Faithful, he will have a faithful, enduring house. It's used of both priestly and royal houses. Zadok's family keeps the priesthood until the destruction of the temple. So partially fulfilled in Zadok's family line. And it's also frequently used of David in Samuel and 2 Samuel 7:16, the promise of an enduring kingdom or reign, and also in Acts 13, when God restores David's reign. But ultimately, of course, it's of our Savior. Well, to eat a morsel of bread seems fitting. As Walkey says, matching the punishment to the crime, Eli's offspring, who fatten themselves on the choice parts of God's offering, will beg for food to eat, in verse 36. Quick application. It is possible to handle the things of God regularly. They officiated at Israel's worship services and failed to have a heart that is sensitive to God's will. In fact, it may be those of us who daily handle the things of Christ are the ones most prone to forget their significance and fall into a laissez-faire approach to the gospel of God. Are we guilty of that? Furthermore, every act of disobedience of God constituted contempt of God and his revelation, according to Numbers, 2 Samuel, and 2 Chronicles. Although one might expect this from a devious person, Proverbs 14:2, Eli the priest, 1 Samuel, King David, 2 Samuel, King Zedekiah, Ezekiel, and the priesthood of Malachi's day treated Yahweh with contempt. When we disobey God, we're demonstrating contempt of God and his revelation. Maybe we need to be reminded of that. Well, ultimately, the fulfillment, of course, would come only in Jesus Christ, the supremely anointed one, designated by God to be a high priest, according to Hebrews 5, forever in the order of Melchizedek, chapter 6, the ancient priest-king of Jerusalem, Hebrews chapter 7. Well, that's the end of our discussion. If you have any comments or questions, please email me at johnson.bob@comcast.net. Lord willing, next lesson, we'll look at 1 Samuel chapter 3.